And that's a long ways away from the high caste Brahman contemplating the unity of his soul with the Atman, with the oversoul of creation. And it's very similar to a peasant worshiping an icon. Worshiping an icon, not using an icon as a symbol. And yet the human spirit will run through this. I think of James Bissett Pratt's description of a peasant in Rangoon in a Buddhist temple. And he was talking to this Buddhist monk who was quite literate. And the peasant was praying to Buddha. And the monk says, "You see, the trouble we have with our illiterates." The monk knew that Buddha couldn't hear. But the peasant woman knew that God could hear. And her religion was a damn sight better than the monk's theology.
Bill, if Moses didn't have to lead a bunch of Bedouins through the desert, look at what the Jewish nation would be today, if he could have really given him his real concept of God.
Sure.
Instead of this watered-down version.
But it wouldn't sell.
It wouldn't sell.
Ignatan wouldn't compromise. And he failed totally. You've got to water down. Look, there were two concepts that plagued Jesus. He never succeeded in rising above either one of them because he had to work with first century brains reared in the Commonwealth of Israel. This was his material. Number one was, you are the Messiah. Number two was the kingdom idea. He did his best to get away from both. Did you ever stop and think that Jesus never wanted to be called the Christ? He was not the Messiah. The word Christ originally is the Greek for Messiah.
Haven't we taken the anointed?
Yeah, it originally meant the anointed one, yes. The anointed in the sense that David was.
Well, that was the Messiah.
Sure, the Messiah was, by most of the Jewish people, was to be a wonderful king. A George Washington, if you please, who would drive the Romans into the sea and let's get our country back. A very laudable patriotic ambition, you know. It was nationalism, yes.
A group god.
Yes, and yet Yahweh was also an international god in another sense. There were two schools of thought. They fought it out during the Babylonian captivity and the nationalists won.
If Moses could have stuck around for about 700 years, do you think he could have eventually elevated this?
Sure. The prophets did a pretty good job. When you start with what Moses had to settle for, and then go as far as 2nd Isaiah, but this is the darndest evolution of religion on the planet. To me, the divinity of the Old Testament has nothing to do with the inspiration of the words, it's the progression of the prophets. This is unique in human history.
But they never dropped the Lord, the one God, Lord of Israel.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, yes. Let me answer.
Okay.
No other group ever had a succession of prophets building one on the other. Other groups have had wise teachers and men who knew truth. But this group had them on the installment plan. And when you conceive of the God of 2nd Isaiah in Babylon, do you realize that Jesus practically quotes all of 2nd Isaiah in his teachings? This is an internationalist God. This is no God of any chosen people. And that's why he was at loggerheads with Jewish nationalism. Dorothy, they whipped him. But the stuff he wrote was so blasted beautiful, they couldn't resist putting it in their scripture.
Mm-hmm.
The sheer beauty of his teaching is what caused it to survive.
And that's why they got so many contradictions.
Yes. He's the one that wrote, "Come now, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, yet shall they be white as wool." Oh, this is a great God. Now, this was the culmination of the teachings of the Jewish prophets. Starting out with the God of Mount Sinai, the spirit demon of Mount Sinai, who gave them some shrewd advice just before you take off for the desert, latch on to all the Egyptian possessions you can glom. But if you get critical of Moses, all you have to do is study Ignatan. Here was an idealist. He wouldn't compromise. And he was the most powerful man on earth because he was the theological head, the temporal king of the best organized state on earth at that time. And he had behind him the full authority of the Egyptian Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. And as long as he lived, he could maintain monotheism. But since he wouldn't compromise, he didn't convert. He drove the priesthood underground. And when he died, they came topside and they chiseled his name off all the temples and went back to polytheism again. Moses would compromise. He made a sale.
Compromise then is a necessity for
him. You don't have a choice. Jesus compromised. Jesus compromised on 2 points. He said, all right, I am the Christ, but not such a Christ as you're expecting. And he never did eradicate the idea of the kingdom of heaven. The idea was catchy. These people thought in those terms. You see, Jesus could not abrogate the free will of the apostles. He couldn't change them. They insisted on these beliefs. So he either had to fire them or else seek to modify them and at least go along with the form of their beliefs. Even Jesus couldn't rise above the grooves in the thinking pattern of his first century AD contemporaries. He did his best to unsell them, but they wouldn't buy. You see, Matty, we're weird mixtures of truth and error. Peter's confession is one of the most human things in this whole book, and it's man at his best. When Jesus said, but who do you say that I am? Extrovert Peter, of course, was the first to speak up, and he said, Master, you are the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter's confession starts in total error and ends in complete truth. This is the way people think. We think half wrong and half right. What are you going to do about it? Jesus didn't debate the error. He accepted the truth. And he told Peter, he said, Simon, he said, no man has told you this, but this has come to you from the Spirit of my Father that indwells you. And on this relationship of the Spirit of God with the soul of man, I will build the kingdom of heaven. In time, the error will be purged and the truth will live. Because you see, truth, error works counter to the grain of the universe. And little by little, century by century, it gets combed out. Whereas truth, since it works with the grain of the universe, little by little and century by century, it's reinforced. And this has something to do, I think, with the Supreme Being, as well as with the Father. Because the finite grain of the universe is determined by the interaction of the Supreme Being, on the one hand, and the Paradise Trinity functioning on the finite level as the Trinity of Supremacy, on the other. This is providence, the interaction of the Supreme Being and the Paradise Trinity. And this determines the grain of time and space. And this is even deeper than the will of God, I think, because this is fundamental. This to me, though, I've used this with people that I've never talked to about the book. This is helpful to human beings in thinking straight, in attempting to be less insane. You know, we're all a little unsane. And I think we can lessen it. I presented this the first time to a group of high school kids many years ago. I put it to them this way. It was up at New Trier. And Miss Velasto asked me to come up. She said, we have Protestants, Jews, Catholics, and God knows what's. And if I get a gentleman of the cloth, I'm in hot water with whoever he wasn't a part of, you know. She said, will you come up and do this? I said, swell, I will. And I'll guarantee they won't know for sure whether I'm a Christian or a Jew, and if I'm a Christian, which kind. And I talked to the kids about this, and I said, look, if your pastor teaches you that the world was created 6,000 years ago, he's talking balderdash. That's a thing. That's facts over here. You go see your general science teacher. If your general science teacher should happen to mention that there is no God, that's balderdash. He didn't, he's dealing with values at all. As a science teacher, he has nothing to do with this. You go see your pastor on that subject.
I've always felt that reality is an individual thing, that what might be very real to me is not real to Mr. Fenderson.
This was debated in the Middle Ages in the schools of the nominalists and the phenomenalists. You remember?
Am I living in the past?
No, but it's a question. But let's put it this way. We would agree that regardless of our interpretation, we are looking at the same thing. And it's in that sense that I'm using the word reality.
Didn't Rodin make a very nice thing on that?
Probably. Do you know where it is?
Yeah, Discussions with Rodin.
Sure. Nominalism versus phenomenalism.
Now, I've often wished that life were like driving a car. There was a white line down the middle of the highway that you could sort of follow. I think I've wasted a lot of time looking for the white line.
It's not there except in principle. They define love as the desire to do good to others, but they stop them. They don't say what is good for others.
Yes, I noticed that.
Yes.
I can't find it.
Is that just what I get?
Mm-hmm. First class.
Go on a little bit and talk about the book.
Mm-hmm.
Just to refresh your memory, we might recap our last year's discussion. We spent some time going over page 2. This foreword discusses just 5 concepts. It discusses, first of all, deity and divinity. It then discusses reality. Deity and divinity occupies the first 3 sections in the foreword. And reality occupies the next 3 sections of the foreword. Deified reality, undeified reality, interassociated reality, actual reality, potential reality, and so on. What is pattern as a reality? The next 3 sections of the foreword talk about experiential deity. Actually, the next 4 sections. The Supreme, the Sevenfold, the Ultimate, and God the Absolute. There are some real juicy sentences in there, too. The next section talks about the 3 Absolutes, and the last section talks about the Trinities. So as you look at it, there are just 5 broad concepts presented in the foreword. Existential deity, reality, experiential deity, the absolutes, the trinities. And then we get into the papers proper, and first of all, they tell the story of deity. And this is the first story of deity. There are five papers on the Father, two on the Son, two on the Spirit, and one on the Trinity. They start out by talking about God as such, his nature, his name. And then they go into a further discussion of his nature, then his attributes. How is he related to the universe, and how is he related to us? In discussing the attributes of God, they really don't discuss his absolute attributes, just his transcendental attributes. I don't think you can put his absolute attributes into English and have them mean very much. Mm-hmm. One, two, three, many. I love that concept. And of course, when you talk about his relationship to us, that's the most interesting of all and the most comprehensible of all. And always, as you study this book, remember, you're not studying a textbook. You're studying a symphony. This book is written the way music is written, not the way a textbook is written. You find themes coming in, and these motifs vanish to be reintroduced in a different key, in a different tempo. They occur and recur. And the best example I can think of is to quote two sentences from this book. The first sentence in paper one says, "The Universal Father is the God of all creation." And the last sentence of the last paper says, "But regardless, when all is said and done, the Father idea is still man's highest concept of God." They start and finish on that same note. The papers on the Eternal Son, the first paper, is very similar to the first three papers on the Father. Naturally, they have less to say about the Son, because since he is a revelation of the Father, they merely say, in these respects, he's like the Father. And the second paper on the Eternal Son parallels the last two papers on the Father, his relation to the universe. I think of the Eternal Son as being the Universal Father minus everything which is in paradise. You see, paradise is non-deity, non-spiritual. And when the Father revealed himself, he made two revelations, one a spiritual one and one a non-spiritual one. And that's why the Eternal Son is so much more comprehensible than the Universal Father. Consider that the Father is the source of paradise, as well as the Father of the Eternal Son. And in the Eternal Son, we see the Universal Father portrayed, but this portraiture is divested of all that is non-spiritual, extra-divine, and undeified. It's easier to understand. And even the Divine Counselor who writes these papers says, even we understand the Father better as we study the Son. And then there are these two fascinating papers on the Infinite Spirit. Paper 8 is somewhat like the first paper on the Son and the first three papers on the Father. But in paper 9 is a real departure. Paper 9, I think, is one of the most exciting papers in the book, because here we're discussing not the Infinite Spirit as the spiritual counterpart of the Father and Son, but paper 9 we encounter the God of action. He is all over everywhere. Be it matter, mind, or spirit, he's got his fingers in the pie. He is the infinite manipulator, the absolute mind, as well as an omnipresent spirit. And then paper 10 is different from the first nine papers. The first nine papers are talking about personal deity, and paper 10 talks about total deity, the Paradise Trinity. And it's got some pretty protean concepts in it, too. These are a bit on the complex side. because it's speaking of a union that is not a personal union. They make the distinction between the personalities of the three deities and the deity natures of these three beings. The Father, Son, and Spirit can unite as persons, but this is not the Trinity. But when they unite as deities, this is the Trinity. There's only one other group of beings that have this power of differential unification, and that's the seven master spirits. When the seven master spirits unite around the third person of deity, and when they unite as deity, not as personality, then in such a unification, they manifest all of the attributes of the third source and center on the level of supremacy and ultimacy on the first two floors, but not absolutes. This is the infinite spirit reassembled in relation to the finite and the absonite levels. This paper points out that the Trinity functions on three levels, and these terms you should have clear. The Trinity of Supremacy is the Paradise Trinity functioning in relation to the finite. The Trinity of Ultimacy is the Paradise Trinity functioning in relation to the absonite. The Trinity of Supremacy is a function which relates to the Supreme Being. The Trinity of Ultimacy is a function which relates to the Trinity Ultimate, the first experiential Trinity, and also to God the Elder. They give no name for the function of the Paradise Trinity on the absolute level, but we know that when the Trinity does thus function, this activates the Deity Absolute and would be inseparable from the function of the Deity Absolute on that level. When we pass beyond paper 10, we start an entirely new story. We're going to school and studying cosmography, the geography of the cosmos. There are five papers that are geographical, and they, again, it's put together like the first 10, only in reverse order. Paper 11 discusses the source of the material universe. And the next group of papers, four in number, discuss what came from this source. Paradise is the source. And the paper on paradise is really in two sections, or two parts. First, they tell us about paradise as a place where God lives and where we're going. And then they tell us about paradise as a function, as one of the absolutes. Someday, incidentally, you want to work out. I did it once. I may do it again. You ought to work out the number of residences portrayed in the story on paradise. And you're up against a geometrical progression here. And in nothing flat, you'll be working in exponents. And before I got through, I was working in exponents of five-figure magnitudes.
Just the residences.
Residential areas on paradise, and these accommodate, each one of these units accommodates a heck of a lot of people. This is like dealing with that many Los Angeleses, if you know what I mean. And then they, by the time you're through with that and you're pretty well staggered, they say, this represents the assignment of much less than 1% of the area available, and the assignment represents a million times in excess of the need.
There's still chance to have acreage.
That's right. This is a real estate man's dream. Well, you see, bud, we're dealing with paradise area, which is non-spatial. and I suspect non-spatial area, whatever that means, has got properties that spatial area doesn't have.
Elastic?
I don't know. If I understood that, I would have mind of the paradise level of function. When we get into the derivations of paradise, first we talk about the total, the universe of universes. And this paper 12 discusses everything which has paradise as its source and origin. It starts out being geographic and descriptive, and then it discusses principles, gravity, space, motion, time, over controls. It's getting philosophical now. It discusses the part in relation to the whole and presents the first full-dress discussion of the difference between a factual approach to matter, mind, and spirit and a truthful approach to matter, mind, and spirit. You might put a note down here. Paper 130, section 7. In their discussion of matter, mind, and spirit. In paper 130, section 7, is Jesus' discourse on time and space at Carthage, I think it was, on the Roman tour. Here we encounter for the first time this challenge. On paradise, the three energies, physical, mental, and spiritual, are coordinate. In the evolutionary cosmos, energy matter is dominant except in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. Then they take up the story of the parts of the whole, starting with the sacred spheres of paradise, and then proceeding outward through Avona and the seven super universes. The sacred spheres of paradise is fascinating because on the Father's worlds there, they seem to have, in germ form, the full potential of the supreme and ultimate growth of the Master Universe. These Trinitized secrets of supremacy are also the Trinitized secrets of ultimacy, even of supreme, of the supreme ultimate. And these worlds fascinate me because we're so mixed up. We know so little. And as they say in an almost exasperated way, we can't tell you. We can't reconcile all these things because you know so little. And if you knew more, you would only become further confused. We have no words in Bantu. The central and divine universe is a twofold story. It starts out geographic and ends descriptive of the people who live there, including something of how we go through there. I think I would note down if you want to get the whole story of the central and divine universe and our progression, then I would read along with it the following. Paper 19, section 6. That's of Avona Natives. Paper 18, section 2. The Eternals of Days. Paper 17, section 5. And associated with this, page 287, paragraph 5, which tells you the story of the circuit spirits. And then for mortal progression, paper 24, section 6 and 7, that's graduate guides. Paper 25, section 1, Avona Servitals. And paper 26, sections 3 to 11, the story of the secondary supernifing. You read all that together and you've got the whole story of what happens to us in Avona. You know, they tell us a lot, only it's spread all over the book. Again, it's written like a symphony, not a textbook. The Seven Super Universes is a whopper of a paper. It tells first the story of the physical side of the super universes. The second half of the paper tells about its administrative organization. We learn about architectural spheres, super universe circuits, and its government. I could give you some cross references there, but it would take up 3 or 4 typewritten pages. And then we start the second half of part one, which is really the third major subdivision. The first 10 papers deal with deity, the next 5 with places, the last 16 papers deal with people. Who runs the show? Who are God's deputies? And they start out with the Supreme Spirits. The paper 16 deals with the first of the Supreme Spirits. It talks about the Master Spirits. And believe me, there's a fascinating discussion. If you think the Trinity is tough, the Master Spirits are only slightly less tough to comprehend because they have so many relationships. They operate in so many different ways. And as you study the functions of Master Spirit number 7, he's all over the lot. He's involved with the Trinity, he's involved with the Supreme Being, he's involved as the collective voice of the Master Spirits, because he's the most nearly balanced of all 7. And the last half of this paper talks about mind and personality and wisdom and us, and how we're put together and how our minds work. And how the basic intuitions of mind. They point out that mind is intuitively responsive to these 3 things. We have a mathematical response. Science always appears in every civilization. We have a worshipful response. Religion always appears in every civilization. We have a moral response. Philosophy always appears in every civilization. It's best exemplified by institutions of justice. And they say this is fundamental to man because civilizations come, civilizations go, but these 3 things always reappear in every civilization because it's constitutive in mind. There's rich reading in the last half of the Master Spirits. This is where you get your best discussion of the cosmic mind. And then in paper 17, they take up the group of which the Master Spirits are a member. This is a group which extends the infinite spirit out into time and space. Be it the 7 Master Spirits, the Circuit Spirits, the Reflective Image Aids, or the Creative Spirits, or the final ministry of teachable mind, the adjutant mind spirits, which I'm trying to use, and I sincerely hope each of you are trying to use right now. That's our thinking juice. As a group, these beings are not such discrete personalities as the sons of God. Some are, some aren't. Let's take inventory. The Master Spirits are. The Circuit Spirits are definitely not. They're impersonal spirits. The Reflective Spirits are in an unfathomable way. They're persons, but we are never allowed to have contact with them. Even the Ancients of Days can't deal with them. Only through their image aids. And these are not persons, they're images. A Creative Spirit is attaining personality as her universe comes into existence in perfection. And the adjutant mind spirits are levels of consciousness of the Creative Spirit. They're entities, but not people. And then there are 2 papers dealing with Trinity origin beings. This, as the Supreme Spirits extend the infinite spirit out into time and space, so do I think of most of these Trinity origin beings as the Trinity steel structure of ultimate stability around which they build this evolutionary creation. They start out with a structure which is just as stable as paradise itself. These Trinity origin beings just don't make mistakes. And the basic group of them include the seven Trinity origin beings and 3 of the coordinate Trinity origin beings. These 10 orders are the order of days, including the Trinity secrets of supremacy, divine counselors, perfectors of wisdom, and universal censors. They're discussed in paper 10 as children of the Trinity. And they've got a special name, the stationary sons of the Trinity. And this is a steel structure out here, extending all the way from paradise to the constellation level, where the faithful of days is the Trinity ambassador. These are absolutely dependable beings. And then you have the roving members, counselors, perfectors of wisdom, and censors. When this last trio speaks, adjudicates, it's as though the ancients of days had adjudicated, and this is the justice of the Paradise Trinity. And then there's a potpourri of beings. There are 4 left over in paper 19 that don't fit so well. Trinity teacher sons that we'll encounter later in their discussion of the sons of God. And in the discussion of Trinity teacher sons, in paper 19, they give you the only statement that's presented in this book as to why this book is not written the way we would write a book. If I wrote this book, I'd start with man, because this is understandable and build inward to God. But they say that's how you get facts, but this is not how you get truth and wisdom. You start at the center of all things and proceed outward to man. You explain man in terms of God, not God in terms of man. They tip their hat in one paragraph to this human desire. In the introduction to the foreword, on page 1, at the bottom of the page, in 2 paragraphs, they start here and go into paradise. Just 2 paragraphs. Your world, Urantia, is one of many similar inhabited planets which comprise the local universe of Nevadon. This universe, together with similar creations, makes up the super universe of Orvantan, from whose capital, Uversa, our commission hails. Orvantan is one of the 7 evolutionary super universes of time and space, which circle the never-beginning, never-ending creation of divine perfection, the central universe of Havona. At the heart of this eternal and central universe is the stationary Isle of Paradise, the geographic center of infinity, and the dwelling place of the eternal God. They did make one small concession to our desire to start here and go in. The 7 evolving super universes, in association with the central and divine universe, we commonly refer to as the grand universe. These are the now organized and inhabited creations. They are all a part of the master universe, which also embraces the uninhabited but mobilizing universes of outer space. Isn't there a terrific lot packed in there? It's 2 paragraphs, a third of a page or less. They go on to discuss in here inspired Trinity spirits, which are fascinating beings. Nobody knows much about them. Even beings of origin in the Paradise Trinity don't know much about them. And this paper offers a wonderful illustration of the difference between curiosity and damn foolishness. The perfecter of wisdom, I believe, who writes the paper on the sacred spheres of the Father, says, there are very few places forbidden to me, but one of them is Divinington, the homeworld of the Thought Adjusters. I'm forbidden to land there. And he said, I haven't the least desire to go there. Quite likely, all I would be able to perceive would be personalized adjusters, and I perceive them elsewhere. There's nothing for me on Divinington. But in the paper, in the section dealing with inspired Trinity spirits, the author says, I will never stop my efforts to investigate and penetrate the mystery of these beings of whose origin is so similar to my own. He'd never been told not to do this. What? One of these Trinity origin beings. This is a good example of wisdom in relation to curiosity, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there are the Havana natives and Paradise citizens. They tell us something about the Havana natives in the section dealing with Havana. You find out a little more about them in the section dealing with the core of the finality, because there's one in each finality company of 1,000. They don't tell us much about the Paradise citizens. They're just mentioned, and that's all. Shall we quit for this afternoon? I run a little over time. Yes.
Betty?
All the different people wrote it. I had nothing to do with
it. Betty, do a kind of heavy one.
Sons of the Trinity. And Trinity.
Just in the TV here.
Yes.
Well, I did try that. It's a whole bunch of course that it works.
The question is, what's the difference between sons of the Trinity and Trinitized sons? The sons of the Trinity are beings of origin in the Trinity, such as the Supreme Trinity origin beings, Trinitized secrets of supremacy, eternals of days, ancients of days, recents, perfections, unions, faithfuls, divine counselors, universal censors, perfectors of wisdom, inspired Trinity spirits, Havana natives and Paradise citizens. Now, Trinity teacher sons, I forgot. A Trinitized being may relate to the Trinity or not, because the word Trinitized is used in two senses in these papers. A being who is Trinitized, or a being who is Trinity embraced. If two creatures Trinitize a being, this is a creature Trinitized son, and has nothing to do with the Trinity unless perhaps the Trinity embraces that being, making, let's say, a creature Trinitized son a most high assistant. Then that being, who started out as the personification of the idea jointly chosen by these two Trinitizing finaliters, let's say, now comes to embrace not only the concept of the two finaliters, but also the Trinity's concept as concerns that one idea, so that such a high sun assistant would become a near absolute authority on that one point, but only on that one point.
Would the Trinity, the person of Trinity who engaged in that Trinitization, have an immediate, would they be an immediately part of the two that had the original concept?
No, let's say the two two finaliters undertook
to
do this.
Trinitized.
Because it's by a technique of Trinitization.
It's by a technique of what?
Of Trinitization.
Well, what's the technique of Trinitization?
A technique of Trinitization is any technique whereby two beings produce another being equal to themselves and are modified as a consequence of this and can never produce another being equal to themselves. And this follows the pattern originally set by the Father and the Son, who trinitized the infinite spirit, a being equal to themselves, and they could never produce a second infinite spirit, only one. And ever since that time, the Father and the Son have been in a peculiar way united as the Father-Son.
Bill, does the Trinitized idea go back then to the original father-son?
Yes, yes.
Idea?
Two creatures can do this. Yes, two creatures can do this. And they can only do it once. Because even deity could produce only one being equal to themselves. Now there's another type. The Trinity can embrace other beings, and these Trinity-embraced beings are referred to as Trinitized sons. Let's take Amadon. Amadon was rebellion-tested, so was Van. They'll ascend to paradise in time, fuse with their adjusters, on the way, be mustered into the core of the finality, enjoy the full satisfaction of service as a finaliter for a time, and then the mandate will be issued drafting on the core of the finality for 700,000 rebellion-tested finaliters. And these 700,000 beings will be withdrawn from the core of the finality, will be embraced by the Paradise Trinity, and will emerge from that embrace as mighty messengers. And they are called Trinitized Sons, or technically, Trinity-embraced Sons. There is still another order of Trinitized Sons, Deity Trinitized Sons. They're listed in the paper on Trinitized Sons, and we know nothing about them whatsoever. We just know that there are such beings. When the Universal Father and the Eternal Son independently conceive of an identical idea, they personify that idea as a Creator Son. This is not Trinitization, because the Creator Son is not the equal of the Universal Father and the Eternal Son. And they can produce any number of these Creator Sons. But when they produced a being equal to themselves, they could never produce another one. There's only one Infinite Spirit. And yet, in many ways, a Creator Son is very much like the Infinite Spirit, isn't he? For the same origin, except the Infinite Spirit is an absolute portrayal of the Father Son, whereas a Creator Son is a sub-absolute portrayal of the Father Son. Finite and absolute, but not absolute. Not absolute in the final sense. But absolute in a partial sense, because by George, if we can penetrate the absolute level, it's a darn shooting cinch that the Michaels can too. They'll be there ahead of us. Question.
Does the Infinite Spirit acting as a conjoint actor, is it absolute? Is he absolute in that sense? As a conjoint
yes,
actor?
Yes, he's absolute. Infinite. He's infinite. There's no limit to what he can do. He also has a compensatory function, making up the inadequacies and deficiencies of experiential deity. In many ways, wherever the Supreme Being can't function, the Infinite Spirit may be in there pitching for him. He goes in as a pinch hitter for evolutionary deity whenever such deity cannot function. He's the versatile deity.
Bill, the Urantia book is the only book that's ever revealed the existence of an eternal son. This son that a lot of Protestant churches refer to, they think it's Jesus, the Father, Son, the Holy Ghost.
As near as I can figure it out, the Trinity of the Christian religion is the Universal Father, the Creator Son, and the Holy Spirit of the Creative Spirit.
And Urantia book is the only one that's revealed this eternal son.
That's right. Question, Bob.
Julie and I were discussing this over the phone, and we couldn't come to a decision, so we decided to ask you. As you may know, there was a flying saucer convention here
yes.
about a week ago at the
staff. There's one in Oklahoma City, too.
We were discussing whether the book says anything about contact with other planets at all. And I thought that they said no. And Julia thought,
well, we weren't sure.
Yeah, so we thought we'd let you.
They don't say anything. However, they put such an embargo on the exchange of information between planets that it would suggest to me that they take an awfully dim view of such things.
Well, that was appealing, Leah, but mm-hmm. we wondered if there was any other way, perhaps through thought of justice, as a, would there be
oh, sure.
any possibility of communication?
Oh, sure. But only with a, I think,
but
by...
But not human, to you.
No.
Do you think possibly after we're settled in life?
I think all bets are off then. Because then you see, you've achieved destiny. And they take these barriers down when you achieve destiny. Here's a pattern that seems to run through the whole creative plan. They want diversification and individuation, and then later on they want to blend it. They take these seven super universes, and they've got the most iron curtain imaginable between each super universe. They want each one to develop its own unique flavor. And if you want to go from the capital of super universe number 7 to either of the adjacent super universes, unless you're a peculiar guy like a solitary messenger, you can't do it. You've got to go into Havona and then come out again. Now, they tell us that when evolution has run its course, when all inhabited worlds have achieved experiential perfection and the Supreme Being takes over, they're going to take these barriers down. And then they're going to foster the commingling of these seven magnificent types of culture which have arisen in each super universe. This reminds me very much of the story of racial evolution on a planet. They plan seven races on a planet. And they want each one of these seven races to achieve its level of culture. And they produce a certain antipathy from as between races, which ensures that these races will draw apart. And they hope that each one will develop its culture. And when this culture has been developed to a certain point, then, through the bestowal of Adam's blood, they try to blend these races. This, to me, is the same pattern taking place. I suspect the same thing has to do with planets. I can't see any reason why two worlds settled in light and life should know all about each other. But let's suppose that we go space adventuring and we wind up on a planet. Odds are it's either way ahead of us or way behind us. Now, if it's way ahead of us, are we entitled to all that unearned information? And if it's way behind us, are we going to be wise enough not to clobber them with a lot of unearned information?
We just couldn't communicate anyway.
No.
If they were way ahead of us, the first power to end up there would try and get all the information they could
sure.
for their own use. And if they
Why
were
certain.
Way behind us, it would be another Africa. They'd start
yes, we'd try to colonize
them. Cutting them into pieces.
That's my point. That's my point. Question.
Well, did I hear you this afternoon say these differences in cultures arise from the fact of freedom of will in an imperfect world?
Sure.
From the imperfection.
Sure.
You think that is true rather than in the basic pattern of personality? For instance, certainly there was a pattern for the seven races, something of a
pattern. Oh, yes. Sure. The life carriers designed it. Each personality is unique, but I'm thinking of the composite total of a culture, a society, a civilization.
In the imperfection.
Sure. It's human will operating imperfectly, producing irregularities from which the evil is finally abstracted. And still, the residual pattern of a de-evilized imperfection would give a peculiar flavor to the culture of a planet.
Even of the seven super universes?
Well, in the seven super universes, of course, you have a pattern set.
Yeah.
Each super universe is dominated by just one of the seven master spirits. And I would compare it to the color spectrum. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Each super universe has got the same foot candles of light, but it's in a different hue. And that saturates the super universe. This determines a basic differentiation. Because each super universe is dominated by this master spirit, and each creative spirit in each local universe in that super universe takes on that same hue when they start to create personalities. Prior to the appearance of Gabriel in Nebadon, the creative spirit was like the infinite spirit. But after the creation of Gabriel, the creative spirit of Nebadon was like master spirit number 7. And she determines the super universe inheritance factor in our local universe. Now, you have 100,000 variations of inheritance in our Vantan, our super universe, because each Michael sun is different from any other Michael sun. And he sets the local universe variety of inheritance in that super universe. And then you start in with all of the other personalities, which impart a peculiar flavor to that local universe, partly by the design of the creating beings, partly by their own decision, until you wind up with critters like us who are apt to do anything, you know?
And the experimental worlds inside the local universe.
Yes. This adds still different flavor. They're seeking for variety. They're seeking to avoid monotony. They're seeking for the stimulus of change. In Havona, you see it by the fiat of creation. Out here, it's being done by apparent chance. And yet, in the book, it instructs me, blind and unforeseen accidents do not happen in the cosmos. It's a very mysterious statement. It makes sense to me. It feels right to me, but I can't explain it. More questions?
You implied a minute ago that there was a limit to the mighty messengers. You might ask that in a question.
Yes.
Did I understand you wrongly? I've forgotten. I'm asking for information. Whether 700,000 is the limit?
No, no. They're Trinity embraced in 700,000 groups.
Oh,
and this is a continuing process. I think it's 700,000. Will someone check me on that? Do you remember?
No, I didn't.
We will check it.
Page 245.
Hmm?
Page what? Well, Mighty Messengers, anyhow. There's a section called Mighty Messengers on 245.
$700,000 is right. $100,000 for each super universe. There are almost 1 trillion of them on Universa. That's a lot of them, you know.
Oh my, in one for the universe.
More questions? Let's clean them up as they come up, because they're valuable.
It goes back to an earlier chapter, but could you tell me the difference between the absonite and the ultimate? The absonite and God the ultimate. Absonite is in that
they're related.
Paragraph. I know that they're not the same, but does one make use of the other?
The word absonite is to God the ultimate, as the word finite is to God the supreme. The absonite is a stage of action on which the ultimate is eventuating. The finite level is a stage of action on which the supreme being is evolving. One refers to a level, the other refers to a person. The word, ma'am?
Could you do that again?
Yes. Go back to our firehouse, which you can still dimly see.
Yes.
To the second floor of the firehouse, I would give the name absonite. And in this sense, I would use it as synonymous with transcendental. This is the level on which the ultimate, God the ultimate, is eventuating by experiential techniques. The word ultimate also applies to the values on that level. The word ultimate also applies to the function of the Paradise Trinity on that level, the Trinity of ultimacy. The ultimate also applies to the function of the first experiential Trinity, denoted the Trinity ultimate, made up of the Supreme Creators, and the architects of the Master Universe. Those are the uses of the word ultimate. But ultimate all by itself, capitalized, would mean God the ultimate. Ultimate, uncapitalized, would refer to the level of values on that second floor. As the word supreme, capitalized or uncapitalized, would similarly refer to deity or to a level of quality on the first floor, the finite level. Finite is to supreme, roughly, as absinthe is to ultimate. Question.
Because it's further from the original start of the word thing, could we be justified in thinking it's further from perfect?
The absinthe or ultimate?
The absinthe.
No, I think it's nearer perfect. As I think of absinthe, let's go back to page 3.
Where does evolution come from?
On the finite level, primarily, I believe. On page 3, they talk about levels of divinity. They talk about absolute perfection, relative perfection, and imperfection. Now, don't make this one go on all fours. But roughly, very roughly, I would think of the absinthe level as being relatively perfect. Now, I don't think that's what this is intended to illustrate, but that would come nearer fitting this pattern than any other concept presented here. Again, when they talk about Havona, Havona is not absolute. It is not absolute. Havona is not really finite. It is not finite. The papers say Havona is nearer the absinthe than any other concept revealed to us.
That is a hint.
Yes. It's not really absinthe. But then again, the univitatia exists in a level midway between matter and spirit, but they're not Marantians.
Absinthe has been simply an algebraic symbol to me without the remotest idea of anything concrete in it. I can't picture it. I can't think about it.
It's used in many ways. It's used as a quality of personality in association with mind and spirit.
I just feel lost using that term.
Well, it's a superfinite term, Ruth. What's a superperson? We don't know.
One above a person.
But that doesn't mean anything. In terms of our feeling for the word.
It gives you a level to start from.
Yes, yes. But personality represents my concept of maximum being.
Getting back to the Bantus, you can say...
More than many.
Yeah, but if you say stock and relate it to blankets...
Yes.
One blanket equals one chair.
Yes.
Super blankets, bigger than blankets.
Yeah.
They don't know what you're talking about, but they know it's more than blankets.
I understand.
Okay.
In other words, we've said 1, 2, 3, many, more than many.
Okay.
We were talking earlier this morning about the limitations of some African tribes in counting. They can't count above 3, and their number system is 1, 2, 3, many. And we were discussing the problems of dealing with degrees of many when you have no numbers up there. And trying to, by analogy, reason into our problem and understanding some of the things in these papers.
You know, could you say this? Man would be finite. God would be infinite. Power controllers and those power centers would be absolute.
No. The universe power directors are finite. But the force organizers are transcendental, absentite beings.
Then force organizers, man is finite, God is infinite, and power,
force organizers
are absent.
And the architects of the master universe are absent.
Okay.
But a better illustration would be to say Avona Native is finite. Now you're dealing with a perfect being. Man is not only finite, he's a pretty lousy finite. He's an imperfect finite.
Sub-finite.
No, he's a becoming.
On the floor.
That's right. That's right. Or maybe we start in the basement.
But when the Father wanted to reveal himself to finite beings, he made a finite.
Yes, I think so.
For a finite God.
Yes, right, the supreme being. Check.
In other words, just because you're finite isn't a stigma.
Oh, no.
Because you got everything that an absentite has, or an absolute, well, no, I don't want to say that. You have everything that an absentite has, except...
You have absentite potential. You have the plumbing roughed in.
Yeah. But you still have no less opportunity as a finite...
That's right.
...to do everything an absentite can do, except you're doing it on a finite scale. Rephrase. The distances between the floor and the ceiling of each level of the firehouse are equal. And any finite can go from the floor to the ceiling, as well as any absentite can go from the floor to the ceiling.
I'll buy that. The distances are not equal, but they're proportional.
All right.
I would say that the distance between the floor and ceiling on the first floor is about 2 inches. The distance between the floor and ceiling on the second floor is on the order of 1,600 miles.
But in an equation.
And there is no roof on the third floor. It's an infinite distance.
But quantitatively, you couldn't equate it. But qualitatively, could they be equated?
Qualitatively, yes.
Yeah.
The first and second floor are comparable. But all bets are off on the third floor.
Bill, I have a question. Do finite mortals go through the stage of finite, you know, from the floor to the ceiling and then from the floor to the ceiling and the afternoon?
Yes. And they attempt to reach the ceiling on the third floor, but there isn't any. Which means that you never get shut in. Yes.
Well, I don't understand why they have eliminated the like the finite, the mortal man, how they can only be finite.
They're finite in the perfect sense of the word. Well, why shouldn't there be finites in Havana? The pattern creatures...
finites in paradise.
The pattern creatures for human beings are found on the outer circuits of Havana. Something of everything that's going to appear in the master universe.
Well, you know that Havana natives were created.
Yes, right. They're finite, but they're perfect finite beings.
Bill?
Yes?
There's finites in paradise.
Oh.
Finaliters are really finite.
Oh,
they
yes.
had beginnings.
That's right.
They are time, space, conscious.
I don't know about the status of a paradise citizen. The book tells us nothing.
No, but a finaliter residing in paradise.
Oh, sure.
Is a finite.
I think a primary supernafim is a finite being. And they're born on paradise. They're angels. Paradise angels.
But they're perfect.
Of course. Now look, let's go back to the concept of maximums. I'm quoting the book. This universe at the present time contains primary finite maximums. Now, let's analyze that. The word primary suggests there is something other than primary, namely secondaries, which are dissimilar. These beings are finite. These beings are also maximum. This means in terms of the finite level, they can't do much growing. They've had it. They're full-blown beings. They're at the finite ceiling. Are you with me? When a finaliter, let's take a finaliter, and let's forget about the seventh stage of spirit. Let's say that the sixth stage is his limit, which indeed it is, in the present universe age. He is a finite maximum. He's gone as far as he can go in status. He's not a primary finite maximum. He's a secondary finite maximum, as the book describes it. He has become the peer, the coordinate of a Havona native. Not by origin, but by achievement. When you want to compare humans and Havoners, you must compare not humans with Havoners, you must compare finaliters with Havoners. Now you're comparing two maximums.
Yeah.
We're incomplete secondary finites. We're just beginning. Yes.
When we're finaliters.
Right.
Where are we in relation to the floor and the ceiling?
We're getting up near the ceiling of the first floor.
Just the finite realm?
Yes.
Well, when do we start the Epsonite?
Not until the next universe age dawns.
Oh, seventh stage.
Except that, Dorothy, we may be fumbling with it in the present universe
yeah,
age.
Yeah, I see.
But we're not going to smash through
yeah.
the floor. We may be listening to the stereo on the second floor. Mm-hmm. But we're still on the first floor.
Uh-huh. There's a chain link fence.
Yeah.
The technique of finding God on the Epsonite level, which we are told we
are trying to
do, is therefore not evolutionary.
Well, God is a thing that emerged,
right?
Yeah.
Ruth, I think it's not evolutionary in the sense of involving the growth of the Supreme.
No, but the
I think it is evolutionary in the sense of being involved in the growth of the ultimate. It is super finite evolutionary, but it's still evolutionary because it's still something which is taking place in time and with which we are participants, and concerning which we can function as conscious, intelligent, cooperating partners with God. Now, no Havona native went into partnership with the Trinity in effecting his own origin. He simply was, that's all, he is. But we will not stop being partners with God in the next universe age. And in that sense, evolution is going right on, but it's going to be super finite evolution. It's going to relate to the growth of the ultimate as finite evolution now relates to the growth of the Supreme.
And the ultimate is an experiential deity.
He is, yes, just as much as is the Supreme. And someday he will achieve completion of growth because he is sub-infinite. Hence that goal is an attainable in time. You know, I wonder how right we are.
Yeah.
You guys ask me questions, and I fire answers back to you. And I often think about, we may have some observers here, and I often wonder if they're chuckling. And are they chuckling ruefully? I tell you, I mean this when I say, all I can share with you is a reasonably well-unified ignorance. I've got my ignorance better unified than yours, so I'll share it with you.
They're probably saying, wait till we get this guy upstairs. Spit him out.
That's right. That's right. They may be saying, talk about Peter's perversion of Jesus' gospel. Look what this guy's doing with the blue book. Every now and then I get a real chilly feeling about all this.